he look like?
He was medium height, medium build. Looked like he was in shape. In his mid-30s, maybe. Dark hair, dark brown, I think. I don't know, Sheriff. He looked like anybody.
Like anybody.
The kid looked at his shoes. He looked up at Bell.
He didn't look like anybody. I mean, there wasn't nothing unusual looking about him, but he didn't look like anybody you'd want to mess with. When he said something, you damn sure listened. There was a bone sticking out under the skin on his arm, and he didn't pay no more attention to it than nothing.
All right.
Am I in trouble over this?
No.
I appreciate it.
You don't know where things will take you, do you?
No, sir, you don't. I think I learned something from it, if that's any use to you.
It is. Do you think DeMarco learned anything?
The boy shook his head.
I don't know, he said. I can't speak for David.
Part 11.
I got Molly to run down his relatives, and we finally found his dad in San Saba. I left to go up there on a Friday evening, and I remember thinking to myself when I left that this was probably another dumb thing I was fixing to do, but I went anyways. I done talked to him on the phone. He didn't sound like he was waiting to see me, or he wasn't waiting, but he said to come on, so here I went. Checked in a motel when I got there and drove out to his house in the morning. His wife had died some years back. We sat out on the porch and drunk iced tea, and I guess we'd have sat there from now on if I hadn't have said something. He was a bit older than me, 10 years maybe. I told him what I'd come to tell him. About his boy. Told him the facts. He just sat there and nodded. He was sitting in a swing, and he just rocked back and forth a little and held that glass of tea in his lap. I didn't know what else to say, so I just shut up, and we sat there for quite some time. And then he said, and he didn't look at me. He just looked out across the yard, and he said, he was the best rifle shot I ever saw, bar none. I didn't know what to say. I said, yes, sir. He was a sniper in Vietnam, you know. I said I didn't know that. He was not in no drug deals. No, sir, he was not. He nodded. He wasn't raised that way, he said. Yes, sir. Was you in the war? Yes, I was, European theater. He nodded. Llewellyn, when he come home, he went to visit several families of buddies of his that had not made it back. He give it up. He didn't know what to say to him. He said he could see him sitting there looking at him and wishing he was dead. You could see it in their faces, in the place of their own loved one, you understand. Yes, sir, I can understand that. I can, too. But aside from that, they'd all done things over there that they just as soon left over there. We didn't have nothing like that in the war, or very little of it. He smacked the tar out of one or two of them hippies, spitting on them, calling them a baby killer. A lot of them boys that come back, they're still having problems. I thought it was because they didn't have the country behind them, but I think it might be worse than that, even. The country they did have was in pieces. It still is. It wasn't the hippies' fault. It wasn't the fault of them boys that got sent over there, neither. 18, 19-year-old. He turned and looked at me. And then I thought he looked a lot older. His eyes looked old. He said, people will tell you it was Vietnam brought this country to its knees. But I never believed that. It was already in bad shape. Vietnam was just the icing on the cake. We didn't have nothing to give 'em to take over there. If we'd sent 'em without rifles, I don't know as they'd have been all that much worse off. You can't go to war like that. You can't go to war without God. I don't know what is going to happen when the next one comes. I surely don't. And that was pretty much all that was said. I thanked him for his time. The next day was going to be my last day in the office, and I had a good deal to think about. I drove back to I-10, along the back roads. Drove down to Cherokee and took 501. I tried to put things in perspective, but sometimes you're just too close to it. It's a life's work to see yourself for what you really are, and even then you might be wrong. And that is something I don't want to be wrong about. I've thought about why it was I wanted to be a lawman. There was always some part of me that wanted to be in charge, pretty much insisted on it. Wanted people to listen to what I had to say. But there was a part of me, too, that just wanted to pull everybody back in the boat. If I've tried to cultivate anything, it's been that. I think we are all of us ill-prepared for what is to come, and I don't care what shape it takes. And whatever comes, my guess is that it will have small power to sustain us. These old people I talk to, if you could have told them that there would be people on the streets of our Texas towns with green hair and bones in their noses speaking a language they couldn't even understand, well, they just flat out wouldn't have believed you. But what if you'd have told them it was their own grandchildren? Well, all of that is signs and wonders, but it don't tell you how it got that way. And it don't tell you nothing about how it's fixing to get, neither. Part of it was, I always thought I could at least some way put things right. And I guess I just don't feel that way no more. I don't know what I do feel like. I feel like them old people I was talking about, which ain't gonna get better, neither. I'm being asked to stand for something that I don't have the same belief in it I once did. Asked to believe in something I might not hold with the way I once did. That's the problem. I failed at it even when I did. Now I've seen it held to the light, seen any number of believers fall away. I've been forced to look at it again, and I've been forced to look at myself. For better or for worse, I do not know. I don't know that I would even advise you to throw in with me, and I never had them sorts of doubts before. If I'm wiser in the ways of the world, it come at a price. Pretty good price, too. When I told her I was quitting, she at first didn't take me to mean it literally, but I told her I did so mean it. I told her I hoped the people of this county would have better sense than to even vote for me. I told her I didn't feel right taking their money. She said, well, you don't mean that, and I told her I meant it, every word. We're $6,000 in debt over this job, too, and I don't know what I'm going to do about that either. Well, we just sat there for a time. I didn't think it would upset her like it done. Finally, I just said, Loretta, I can't do it no more. And she smiled, and she said, you aim to quit while you're ahead? And I said, no, ma'am. I just aim to quit. I ain't ahead by a damn sight. I never will be. One other thing, and then I'll shut up. I would just assume that it hadn't have got told, but they put it in the papers. I went up to Ozona and talked to the district attorney up there, and they said I could talk to that Mexican's lawyer if I wanted and maybe testify at the trial, but that was all they could do, meaning that they wouldn't do nothing. So I wound up doing that, and of course it didn't come to nothing, and the old boy got the death penalty. So I went up to Huntsville to see him, and here's what happened. I walked in there and sat down, and he, of course, knew who I was, as he'd seen me at the trial and all, and he said, "What did you bring me?" And I said, "I didn't bring him nothing." And he said, well, he thought I must have brung him something, some candy or something. Said he figured I was sweet on him. I looked at the guard, and the guard looked away. I looked at this man. Mexican, maybe 35, 40-year-old, spoke good English. I said to him that I didn't come up there to be insulted, but I just wanted him to know that I'd done the best I could for him, and that I was sorry because I didn't think he'd done it. And he just reared back and laughed, and he said, "Where do they find somebody like you? Have they got you in diapers yet?" I shot that son of a bitch right between the eyes and drug him back to his car by the hair of the head and set the car on fire and burned him to grease. Well, these people can read you pretty good. If I had have smacked him in the mouth, that guard would not have said word one, and he knew that. He knew that. I seen that county prosecutor coming out of there, and I knowed him just a little to talk to, and we stopped and visited some. I didn't tell him what had happened, but he knew about me trying to help that man, and he might could have put two and two together, I don't know. He didn't ask me nothing about him. Didn't ask me what I was doing up there or nothing. There's two kinds of people that don't ask a lot of questions. One is too dumb to, and the other don't need to. I'll leave it to you to guess which one I figure him to be. He's just standing there in the hall with his briefcase, like he had all the time in the world. He told me that when he got out of law school, he'd been a defense attorney for a while. He said it made his life too complicated. He didn't want to spend the rest of his life being lied to on a daily basis just as a matter of course. I told him that a lawyer one time told me that in law school they try and teach you not to worry about right and wrong, but just follow the law, and I said I wasn't so sure about that. Well, he thought about that, and he nodded, and he said that he pretty much had to agree with that lawyer. He said that if you don't follow the law, right and wrong won't save you. Which I guess I can see the sense of, but it don't change the way I think. Finally, I asked him if he knew who Mammon was, and he said, "Mammon? Yes, Mammon. You mean like in God and Mammon? Yes, sir." "Well," he said, "I can't say as I do. I know it's in the Bible. Is it the devil?" "I don't know. I'm going to look it up. I got a feeling I ought to know who it is." He kindly smiled, and he said, "You sound like he might be getting ready to take up the spare bedroom." "Well," I said, "that would be one concern. In any case, I feel I need to familiarize myself with his habits." He nodded, kind of smiled. Then he did ask me a question. He said, "This mystery man you think killed that trooper and burned him up in his car? What do you know about him?" "I don't know nothing. I wish I did. Or I think I wish it. Yeah. He's pretty much a ghost. Is he pretty much or is he one?" "No. He's out there. I wish he wasn't. But he is." He nodded. "I guess if he was a ghost, you wouldn't have to worry about him." I said that was right. But I've thought about it since, and I think the answer to his question is that when you encounter certain things in the world, the evidence for certain things, you realize that you have come upon something that you may very well not be equal to, and I think that this is one of them things. When you've said that it's real, and not just in your head, I'm not all that sure what it is you have said. Loretta did say one thing. She said something to the effect that it wasn't my fault, and I said it was. And I had thought about that, too. I told her that if you got a bad enough dog in your yard, people will stay out of it. And they didn't.
When he got home, she wasn't there, but her car was. He walked out to the barn, and her horse was gone. He started to go back to the house, but then he stopped, and he thought about her maybe being hurt. And he went to the tack room and got his saddle down and carried it out into the bay and whistled at his horse and watched his head come up over the stall door at the end of the barn with his ears scissoring. He rode out with the reins in one hand, patting the horse. He talked to the horse as he went.
Feels good to be out, don't it? You know where they went? That's all right. Don't you worry about it. We'll find them.
40 minutes later, he saw her and stopped and sat the horse and watched. She was riding along a red dirt ridge to the south, sitting with her hands crossed on the pommel. Looking toward the last of the sun, the horse slogging slowly through the loose sandy dirt, the red stain of it following them in the still air.
"That's my heart yonder," he told the horse. "It always was."
They rode together out to Warner's Well and dismounted and sat under the cottonwoods while the horses grazed. Doves coming into the tanks.
"Late in the year, we won't be seeing them much longer."
She smiled.
"Late in the year," she said.
"You hate it."
"Leaving here?"
"Leaving here."
"I'm all right."
"Because of me, though, ain't it?"
She smiled.
"Well," she said, "past a certain age, I don't guess there's any such thing as good change."
"I guess we're in trouble, then."
"We'll be all right.
I think I'm going to like having you home for dinner."
"I like being home any time."
"I remember when Daddy retired, Mama told him. I said for better or for worse, but I didn't say nothing about lunch."
Belle smiled.
"I'll bet she wishes he could come home now."
"I'll bet she does, too. I'll bet I do, for that matter."
"I shouldn't ought to have said that."
"You didn't say nothing wrong."
"You'd say that anyways."
"That's my job."
Belle smiled.
"You wouldn't tell me if I was in the wrong?"
"Nope."
"What if I wanted you to?"
"Tough."
He watched the little brindle desert doves come stooping in under the dull rose light.
"Is that true?" he said.
"Pretty much. Not altogether."
"Is that a good idea?"
"Well," she said, "whatever it was, I expect you'd get it figured out with no help from me. And if it was something we just disagreed about, I reckon I'd get over it."
"Where I might not."
She smiled and put her hand on his.
"Put it up," she said. "It's nice just to be here."
"Yes, ma'am. It is indeed."
Part 12.
I'll wake Loretta up just being awake myself. Be laying there and she'll say my name, like asking me if I'm there. Sometimes I'll go in the kitchen and get her a ginger ale and we'll sit there in the dark. I wish I had her ease about things. The world I've seen has not made me a spiritual person. Not like her. She worries about me, too, I see it. I reckon I thought that because I was older and the man, that she would learn from me, and in many respects she has. But I know where the debt lies. I think I know where we're headed. We're being bought with our own money, and it ain't just the drugs. There is fortunes being accumulated out there that they don't nobody even know about. What do we think is going to come of that money? Money that can buy whole countries, it done has. Can it buy this one? I don't think so. but it will put you in bed with people you ought not to be there with. It's not even a law enforcement problem. I doubt that it ever was. There's always been narcotics, but people don't just up and decide to dope themselves for no reason, by the millions. I don't have no answer about that. In particular, I don't have no answer to take heart from. I told a reporter here a while back, young girl, seemed nice enough. She was just trying to be a reporter. She said, "Sheriff, how come you let crime get so out of hand in your county?" Sounded like a fair question, I reckon. Maybe it was a fair question. Anyway, I told her, I said, "It starts when you begin to overlook bad manners. Anytime you quit hearing sir and ma'am, the end is pretty much in sight." I told her, I said, "It reaches into Everstrata. You've heard about that, ain't you? Everstrata? You finally get into the sort of breakdown in mercantile ethics that leaves people setting around out in the desert dead in their vehicles, and by then, it's just too late." She gave me kindly a funny look. So the last thing I told her, and maybe I shouldn't have said it, I told her that you can't have a dope business without dopers. A lot of 'em are well-dressed and holding down good-paying jobs, too. I said, "You might even know some yourself." The other thing is the old people, and I keep coming back to them. They look at me, it's always a question. Years back, I don't remember that. I don't remember it when I was sheriff back in the 50s. You see 'em, and they don't even look confused. They just look crazy. That bothers me. It's like they woke up and they don't know how they got where they're at. Well, in a manner of speaking, they don't. At supper this evening, she told me she'd been reading St. John, the Revelations. Anytime I get to talking about how things are, she'll find something in the Bible. So I asked her if Revelations had anything to say about the shape things was taken, and she said she'd let me know. I asked her if there was anything in there about green hair and nose bones, and she said not in so many words there wasn't. I don't know if that's a good sign or not. Then she come around behind my chair and put her arms around my neck and bit me on the ear. She's a very young woman in a lot of ways. If I didn't have her, I don't know what I would have. Well, yes, I do. You wouldn't need a box to put it in, neither. It was a cold, blustery day when he walked out of the courthouse for the last time. Some men could put their arms around a crying woman, but it never felt natural to him. He walked down the steps and out the back door and got in his truck and sat there. He couldn't name the feeling. It was sadness, but it was something else besides. And the something else besides was what had him sitting there instead of starting the truck. He'd felt like this before, but not in a long time. And when he said that, then he knew what it was. It was defeat. It was being beaten, more bitter to him than death. "You need to get over that," he said. Then he started the truck. Part 13. Where you went out the back door of that house, there was a stone water trough in the weeds by the side of the house. A galvanized pipe come off the roof, and the trough stayed pretty much full. And I remember stopping there one time and squatting down and looking at it, and I got to thinking about it. I don't know how long it had been there. 100 years, 200. You could see the chisel marks in the stone. It was hewed out of solid rock, and it was about 6 foot long and maybe 1.5 feet wide and about that deep. Just chiseled out of the rock. And I got to thinking about the man that done that. That country had not had a time of peace, much of any length at all that I knew of. I've read a little of the history of it since, and I ain't sure it ever had one. But this man had set down with a hammer and chisel and carved out a stone water trough to last 10,000 years. Why was that? What was it that he had faith in? It wasn't that nothing would change, which is what you might think, I suppose. He had to know better than that. I thought about it a good deal. I thought about it after I left there, with that house blown to pieces. I'm going to say that water trough is there yet. It would have took something to move it, I can tell you that. So I think about him sitting there with his hammer and his chisel, maybe just an hour or two after supper, I don't know. And I have to say that the only thing I can think is that there was some sort of promise in his heart. And I don't have no intentions of carving a stone water trough, but I would like to be able to make that kind of promise. I think that's what I would like most of all. The other thing is that I have not said much about my father, and I know I have not done him justice. I've been older now than he ever was for almost 20 years, so, in a sense, I'm looking back at a younger man. He went on the road trading horses when he was not much more than a boy. He told me the first time or two he got skinned pretty good, but he learned. He said this trader one time, he put his arm around him, and he looked down at him, and he told him, said, "Son, I'm going to trade with you like you didn't even have a horse." Point being, some people will actually tell you what it is they aim to do to you, and whenever they do, you might want to listen. That stuck with me. He knew about horses, and he was good with them. I've seen him break a few, and he knew what he was doing. Very easy on the horse. Talked to him a lot. He never broke nothing in me, and I owe him more than I would have thought. As the world might look at it, I suppose I was a better man, bad as that sounds to say, bad as that is to say. That has got to have been hard to live with, let alone his daddy. He would never have made a lawman. He went to college, I think, 2 years, but he never did finish. I've thought about him a lot less than I should have, and I know that ain't right neither. I had 2 dreams about him after he died. I don't remember the first one all that well, but it was about meeting him in town somewheres, and he'd give me some money, and I think I lost it. But the second one, it was like we was both back in older times, and I was on horseback going through the mountains of a night, going through this pass in the mountains. It was cold, and there was snow on the ground, and he rode past me and kept on going, never said nothing. He just rode on past, and he had this blanket wrapped around him, and he had his head down, and when he rode past, I seen he was carrying fire in a horn, the way people used to do, and I could see the horn from the light inside of it, about the color of the moon. And in the dream, I knew that he was going on ahead, and that he was fixing to make a fire somewhere out there in all that dark and all that cold. And I knew that whenever I got there, he would be there. And then I woke up.
The End. You've been listening to No Country for Old Men by Cormac McCarthy. Narrated by Tom Stecholty.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.